Welcome to RHRealityCheck.org's RealityCast, where we inject truth into the sex and reproductive health debate. Each week, we'll be bringing you news, opinion, and advice on sexual health issues, as well as interviews with some of the most prominent names in sexual health advocacy. Here's your host, Amanda Marcotte.
This week, I'll be interviewing Belle Taylor McGee from Pharmacy Access about emergency contraception, crowing over some pro-choice victories in the contraception wars, talking about hitting on women when women are sick of being hit on, and covering yet another insult to women from the Bush administration. Good news and bad news this week in the ongoing fight between the thuggish anti-choice movement and the pro-choice community. First, the good news.
State's attorney says no crimes were committed when Planned Parenthood filed permits to open a clinic in Aurora. The brand new facility has drawn some massive protests because it will offer abortions. Some claim the developer lied to Aurora officials by not revealing the tenant of the building would be Planned Parenthood. The clinic was slated to open last month, but the city kept it closed pending the investigation.
That's the good news. The bad news is that while the Aurora Planned Parenthood managed to evade anti-choice blackmailing tactics, the one that's being built in Denver has not been so lucky. Austin's own anti-choice nut Chris Danz, who really polished the art of using intimidation campaigns against construction companies to delay the building of an Austin Planned Parenthood for 2 months a few years ago, has announced plans to go to Denver to make sure that every contractor in the city knows that Danz and his thugs know where they live, where their children go to school, where the people they contract with live, etc. Not a threat. Not anything that's openly a threat. If you read a threat into being told that you're being watched by a bunch of wild-eyed, misogynist, religious fanatics, that's your problem. Perhaps our Congress could spend a little less time crafting condemnations of various media types and a little more time aiming some legislation at people who engage in what we'd call protection rackets if they were only doing it to make money instead of stifle women's rights. The past couple of weeks have not gone well for the anti-contraceptive portion of the anti-choice agenda. As those of us who watch the anti-choice movement closely can attest, lying is a favorite anti-choice tool. But the problem with lies is that they have to have enough plausibility in them to take off. Telling people that emergency contraception is abortion works as a lie, because most people aren't too well educated on the difference. Telling people that vaccinations turn good girls slutty tends not to go over as well. So far, Catholic officials who want to lie to people to get them not to use condoms simply tell people condoms don't work. But apparently, too many people were using this simple, life-preserving technique because Archbishop Francisco Chimoio told BBC reporters that he thinks condoms actually cause AIDS, that there's HIV on the condoms themselves. In case that lie wasn't deadly enough, he also added that he thinks antiretroviral drugs are a poison being used to kill off the African people. Lying to people so they get sick and then lying to them so they don't take life-saving drugs, that's the side that people call pro-life, which is starting to sound like a sick joke to me. The good news is that anti-contraception activists lost a big battle last week in the U.S., The Supreme Court refused to hear a case about whether or not religious organizations in New York can refuse to extend contraception coverage to their employees. The refusal upheld the lower court's ruling, which stated that even if your employer is hiding behind religion, they can't deny you your basic rights. It was a victory for both women's rights and for religious freedom. Anti-choicers who hide behind religion also lost another battle in Connecticut. Catholic hospitals in the state have reluctantly agreed to allow rape victims to have emergency contraception when they show up for care. In the past, these ever-so-charitable hospitals, when faced with women who had just suffered rape and were in desperate need of generous care, would have to tell these young women, too bad, so sad, if they didn't want to get pregnant. Because nothing helps you get over the trauma of rape better than having a hospital worker tell you that not only did the rapist violate your bodily integrity, Catholic dogma would do it again. The hospital started allowing workers to give full care to rape victims a few days before the state law forced them to do it, presumably so they could claim they did it voluntarily. I guess maintaining the illusion of control was important, even though they don't seem to respect the right to control something as basic as your own fertility.
I'd like
to welcome Belle Taylor-McGee to the program. Belle is the Executive Director of the Pharmacy Access Partnership, an organization devoted to expanding access to contraceptive commodities and reproductive health services in pharmacies. Belle's here to talk about life after emergency contraception has been available on demand for one whole year. So, Belle, Plan B has been available for sale over the counter for a year now. How has this change affected pharmacy access and your focus?
I think we've seen significant improvement over the past year, and certainly the years prior to Plan B going OTC, and access in the state of California in particular. As you know, California is one of 9 states that allows pharmacists to provide direct access to emergency contraception, which means that the pharmacist can initiate the prescription for Plan B, and the woman doesn't have to go to a clinic or a doctor first. In California, for example, there are 90% of the counties, 90% of California's counties have at least one pharmacy with a pharmacist trained to provide Plan B through this model. And so I think that we've seen that kind of improvement. I think pharmacy access to EC certainly has gotten a lot of play over the past year with the OTC, access, because people are looking at, how can we make it more available? How can we allow women to get Plan B without having to jump through hurdles? And pharmacy access is still a viable model to really try and alleviate some of these access barriers. We still have a long way to go, though, in terms of the number of women who make who can access EC for various reasons, and also women who even know that this backup birth control is available to help prevent an unintended pregnancy.
The number of women who are making use of emergency contraception has gone up in the past year, but not enough. There are obviously a lot of women that are not getting the pills when they should. What would you say the major obstacles that are preventing as many women from getting and using this as there should be?
Well, I think I cited EC awareness as problematic, and I would say probably that may be our biggest hurdle, is making sure that women know about emergency contraception, understand its benefits and how it's to be used. I think also there is certainly a problem of awareness and access in underserved communities. According to the California Health Interview Survey, only about half of Latinas and half of Asian women have heard of EC, compared to 93% of white women. And although moderately higher than their Latina and Asian counterparts, only 81% of African American women are aware of how EC works and where to get it. So we still have a lot to do in terms of access in communities of color. Additionally, we have the problem of pharmacists not stocking EC. There are no laws necessarily to require that a pharmacy stock emergency contraception, and I think in some parts of the country that's problematic. There's also the issue, and the biggest issue I think that we're dealing with right now, is ensuring that young women have access to emergency contraception. The Food and Drug Administration restricts Plan B for young women by allowing women 18 and over to get Plan B without any kind of proof of identity. They can, if you're 18 and over, you can get EC without any restrictions. It's actually over the counter. For women under 18, 17 and younger, they have to have a prescription. So Pharmacy Access Partnership has been working very, very closely with a number of allied organizations who work specifically on youth issues, trying to make sure that we can eliminate some of these barriers for young women in particular. And in focus groups that we've done over the past year or so, one of the things that we hear from women over and over again, young women in particular, and young women of color, is that they feel judged when they try and access any kind of reproductive confidential services among providers. And so emergency contraception is certainly no exception. So we want to also say that training a pharmacist is really key to mitigating the opportunities when a woman would walk in and not get what she needs.
I hear conflicting stories all the time about whether or not emergency contraception has lowered the abortion rate in countries where it's been legal and sold over the counter for a few years now.
You know, some sources say that it has lowered the abortion rate. Some say it hasn't. What's the real story there?
I think that we can definitely say that emergency contraception has the potential of reducing unintended pregnancy rates as well as abortion rates among women who use it. I think in order to really see a significant impact among the population, we need to ensure that women use EC at every act of unintended pregnancy. And so you can't just use it now and then. If you have unintended pregnancy for whatever reason, then EC needs to be taken at every act of unintended, at every act of unprotected sex. So that would be the issue there, making sure that it's used at every act of unprotected sex. I think the other issue is that although EC has no contraindications in more than 60 countries, women need a doctor's prescription to get EC. Again, you know, we still have these barriers to access that depending on where you live and what your income is, you may or may not be able to access emergency contraception without any problems. And also, there is the problem of people not understanding, women and even providers themselves, not understanding the difference between emergency contraception, at least the mechanism of action, and RU486, which is the abortion pill. People still get those two confused. And RU486 is emergency contraception is not an abortifacient. It actually prevents an unintended pregnancy after unprotected sex, whereas RU486 can terminate an early pregnancy. So there's a lot of education that needs to be done around the mechanism of action for emergency contraception and how it's used.
If you'd like to learn more about Pharmacy Access Partnership, please visit their website at pharmacyaccess.org. Thanks for coming on to RealityCast, Belle.
Thank you very much for having me.
The Bush administration continues to deliver slaps to the face of American women with the appointment last week of Dr. Stephen Galson, the former director of the FDA's Drug Evaluation Division, to the position of Acting Surgeon General. If you haven't figured out from his former title, Dr. Galson was one of the wingnuts who stalled the approval of emergency contraception, known as Plan B, from being sold over-the-counter. Stalled for years, mind you, at the behest of anti-contraceptive activists. Once it was approved, Dr. Galson went into damage control mode, trying to push the storyline that he and other anti-choice FDA members had real health concerns, when it appeared to all thinking Americans that they were in fact using the FDA's power to try to control the sexual behavior of free citizens. On PBS's NewsHour, Dr. Galson denied the accusations of using the FDA to mess with people's private decisions.
One of the arguments continually made by social conservative groups was that making this available to women might give them a false sense of security and might lead to more sexual promiscuity. Mm-hmm. Do you believe that the availability of Plan B will change sexual behavior?
You're asking a complicated question having to do with promiscuity and sexual behavior. There are parts of sexual behavior, such as use of other kinds of contraceptions like condoms, that aren't necessarily related to promiscuity. The assessment of promiscuity was not part of our assessment. We don't have regulatory jurisdiction over that part of sexual behavior. We did look at concomitant use of other forms of birth control, such as condoms, because from a public health perspective, it's very, very important, because condoms decrease transmission of sexually transmitted diseases, including HIV. So we did look at that. That was important. But the promiscuity part, we don't regulate. It wasn't part of the assessment.
But the sexual behavior.
I've got a memo from August 26, 2005 by Steve Galson that indicates otherwise. In it, he writes, and I quote, "The less developed cognitive abilities of women under age 17 could lead to inappropriate use of Plan B and the potential for younger women engaging in risky sexual behavior, behaviors which carry significant safety and efficacy concerns." Hardly the disinterested stance towards promiscuity that he's laying claim to. And of course, the idea that the entire agency was not interested in using their power to muck with people's sex lives was proven untrue by the notorious memo from Dr. Janet Woodcock, Deputy Operations Commissioner, where she suggested Plan B would lead kids to start orgy cults based around the drug.
Now listen up.
Now for this week's mailbag.
My questions are partly about the effectiveness of approaching strangers I'm attracted to, but mostly about its appropriateness. The first question, in which, if any, times and places is it okay to make conversation with strangers? Two girls in one of my classes said that strangers talking to them on a bus or train makes them uncomfortable because they're trapped in a small space for a duration. Yet a boy I know claims to have good natural conversations with people of all ages and both sexes when he rides the train. This is only one example, as the possibilities of meeting strangers are virtually endless and range in formal structure from a classroom to the sidewalk. My second question is it okay to try to talk to a female stranger because I'm attracted to her? I would not have necessarily stopped to talk to her anyway. I always feel guilty about this for some reason. Is it just anxiety, or should I engage only in conversations that happen naturally, whatever that means? My third question is, should I allow attraction to be clear? Is it intimidating to be upfront about attraction, dishonest and sleazy to hide it, or both, or neither? As for question two, is it okay to talk to a female stranger? I feel subconsciously that I should use some pretense so as not to engender discomfort, but then that I'm being manipulative for using the pretense. My fourth question is, what ways of approaching women are there that are respectful and courteous and do not evoke discomfort, even if it is clear that I am attracted to the woman in question?
I think the issue of pretense is a sticky one, because if you feel that it's a pretense to talk to a woman because you find her interesting as a human being and not just as a sex object, then you probably should just leave her alone. Or, to put it another way, the acceptable stance when hitting on someone is to feel that she is self-evidently attractive physically, and now you want to find out if she's got a personality that you also find attractive. Why women so often get irate at men hitting on us is that a lot of men exude this sense that they don't care if you love Radiohead or about your opinions on the war. So if you approach people, it's not that you need to worry about the pretense. Don't have pretenses. Desire to have someone's company not just for the sex potential, but for the pleasure of her company. You can't really fake that, so the best thing to do is go into the situation believing it. That said, the great unfairness for even well-meaning men wanting to hit on women is that most women are going to be defensive and reject you right off the bat. The key is not to take it personally. I know, easier said than done. But women get hit on pretty much nonstop, and often by men who don't grasp the basic concept that no one owes you her time or attention. A lot of men can't seem to tell the difference between sexually harassing someone and hitting on her either. So women get into a reject all approaches mode. On top of it, a lot of women really do have much better things to do at any point in time than entertain would-be suitors. The woman on the train you're eyeballing is probably thinking about her work, and you approaching her will probably just be irritating, and it's nothing personal. So I don't recommend hitting on strangers in public places as a way to get dates. The key to successful dating is to be able to find people to date who you genuinely find interesting as people, and in situations where you can broadcast that interest. Which is why having hobbies that put you in contact with other people is so critical. The woman on the train who knows you're just chatting her up because you like her ass is gonna blow you off. The woman in your political club that you talk politics with knows that you care what she thinks and will be more open to hearing at some point that you also think she's cute. It's not that women are insulted at being thought attractive. What's insulting to us is being told that our looks are all that matters. I'm thinking maybe this last segment could be called The Wisdom of Wing Nuts, but that might be a little over the top. Thanks to Pam Spalding, both of Pam's House Blend and Pandagon, for digging up the silly video of Alan Combs, the most benighted liberal in the country, arguing with one of the lackeys from Concerned Women of America about a children's book called King and King, a fairy tale about two princes who fall in love and get married. The Concerned Women representative is Sandy Rios, and she seems to be under the impression that telling kids that gay couples exist is basically pornography.
Values they're teaching are tolerance, acceptance, the fact that there are different kinds of families. There's not just one kind of family. These children interact with all different kinds of families, kids from all different kinds of families. Those are the values that are being taught here. What's the problem with that?
The problem is those are not values,
sure,
Alan.
They're.
The fact
tolerance
that we teach that sex can be practiced in any form or fashion in a marriage between a man and a man and
sex.
A woman and a woman is the same as a marriage between a man and a woman. That's the part we have
sex,
a problem with. You, there's no sex in marriage? I thought when they got married, they had sex.
Poor Miss Rios. If she can't tell the difference between telling kids that two people are married and going into details about each couple's sex life, how on earth does she explain straight marriages to her children? My God, married couples are everywhere, even straight ones. There's sex around every corner, sexual indoctrination for kindergartners lurking on the wedding bands of every PTA mom. I bet Miss Rios herself is married and has her children living with her and her husband in their den of marital iniquity. Scandalous, really.
That's it for this week's edition of Reality Cast. Please tune in next week for another dose of reality in the sexual health debate. Visit www.rhrealitycheck.org and sign up for our weekly e-newsletter, various news feeds, and daily emails. Thanks for listening and see you next week.